It was May 1968, a glorious, sunny Sunday morning, and the dogwood trees were in full bloom. Barbara and I had driven down Highway 78 from Memphis to the little country church that I grew up in. And now here I was standing in the pulpit of this little white church, white in both senses of the word. I had come back home to teach at Memphis State after completing my MA at the University of Washington. It's an old story. Simple country boy makes good, gets back home. They asked me to be the guest speaker. I was mulling my topic, wondering what it should be when it was revealed to me, or not so much revealed as handed down. Just 1 month before that homecoming, on April the 4th, just miles from where Barbara and I lived in Memphis, Martin Luther King Jr. had stepped out on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel and into American history. I had grown up attending Bethel Presbyterian Church there in rural Mississippi. I had gone to Sunday school. I'd memorized the Bible verses. I'd played my parts in the Christmas plays. My childhood image of God was the proverbial bearded old white man whose wrath you wanted to avoid, though I don't ever remember worrying about it as a kid. Heaven was that place that you went to join those people you loved after you died. I don't remember worrying about that either. I must admit, it never really seemed real to me, this thing called heaven. Sin was a reason to be sent to hell, though I wasn't worried much about that. Mine was a very simple, uncomplicated childhood. The religious concepts I learned as a child were as unquestioned by me as was the segregation of black kids in Mississippi. In the 40s and 50s, my school bus passed by their school. I remember looking through the bus window down the hill at their school, but I never really saw the reality it represented. That was just the way things are. Both my naive concept of God and the practice of segregation remained unquestioned by me until after I entered college in 1960. That was about the age most people began to question things that they've been taught. My questioning about God began privately in my journal. The old bearded white guy just didn't fit into the universe I was studying as a physics major. My grandmother found my journal once when I was visiting, and it broke her heart, which just about broke my heart. My questioning of the practice of segregation was even slower to take hold. The integration of Little Rock High School in 1957 took place just 50 miles from where I was going to school in Searcy. Eisenhower ended up having to send the 101st Airborne Division of the Army in to trump the governor's National Guard. This dramatic piece of American history was hardly noticed by me and my white classmates. I was much more concerned about getting skirts for my daddy's 56 Bel Air Chevrolet, blue and white, two-tone. Even in college in the early 60s, lots was going on, like the stuff that Homer just read, but I was more focused on school, work, marriage, and fun. I was looking, but I was not really seeing. I completed my MA in 1966. Barbara had been raised up here, so going to the University of Washington for my MA seemed like a logical place. Then we went back to Memphis, where I taught English at my alma mater. Barbara and I had been to Europe for 4 months, and now I had lived outside the South for 2 years. Like most young adults, I had simply dropped out of religion. Theological questions about God no longer bothered me, and I was getting ready to question the much more down-to-earth issue, the one which in mid-20th century America was labeled the Negro problem. I can still recall my grandfather's comment. Barbara and I were visiting Pappy and Mommy down at the rural Mississippi farm. It was twilight, my favorite time of day. We were sitting on the front porch. The Bob White was whistling. The frogs were croaking. Pappy, at that time, would have been about 70. He was wiry thin, tanned, very dark from years of chopping cotton in the sun. "You know, Billy," he said to me, "they're calling them Black Americans now." He was born and raised in Mississippi, but he never used the N-word. He and my grandmother always referred to colored people. They were out of the linguistic evolutionary stream of the language at the time that took us through colored to Negro to Afro-American to Black to African-American, and now back again, of course, to people of color. Of course, not colored people, but people of color, as Benedict Cumberbatch learned so badly. Up the road in Memphis at the university, though, I was very much in the flow of linguistic evolution. There were a few Afro-Americans in my classes. Yes, and some of them sported afros. One of them called me up on August the 10th, 1967. I know the exact date because it was our fifth wedding anniversary. It was Saturday, and he wanted me to come bail him out of jail. It made that anniversary kind of memorable. That fall, the Black Student Union at Memphis State gave me this. And I only thought about this a few weeks ago in Kate's Witnessing Whiteness class. I was telling the story came to mind as we were talking in one of our small groups. Bailing a Black student out of jail in 1967 was something a moderate white could do. I did not, however, really have the dedication to change that Martin Luther King is calling for in his letter from Birmingham jail. That would require further opening of the eyes. There was a garbage strike in Memphis. Susan spoke about this a few weeks ago. Martin Luther King had been asked to come. The garbage strikers were, of course, all Black. Those men marched in picket lines wearing placards declaring, "I am a man." In those days in Memphis, an adult Black male was frequently called boy. On April the 3rd, Dr. King addressed a large crowd in the sanctuary of the largest Black church in Memphis, the Church of God in Christ. He told them that he might not make it with them, but we as a people will get to the promised land. His words that evening proved all too prophetic. Following his death the next day, cities all over America went up in flames. It happened right at news time. And it hit like a brick. Barbara and I put our one-year-old son to bed and sat up that evening watching the news. Switching through the three major networks, we saw reports of the assassination, the pursuit of the killer, and the response throughout the country. We could hear the sirens outside. The networks filled the air between times with footage from the famous civil rights scenes, Birmingham, Selma, Chicago, the Nobel Prize, the I Have a Dream speech, you know the history. Our eyes were opened to what we had not been seeing. That evening changed us both, converted us from the passive condition of the moderate white into an active state of opposing racism, of questioning the way things are, of seeking change. Like many young dropouts, Barbara and I returned to church when we had kids. We were attending a large Methodist church there in the University District. It was like my little country church, though, all white. A couple of months after the assassination, we proposed to our Sunday school class the idea of exchanging with a black church, the largest black Methodist church in town, and the class agreed. So we contacted Jim Lawson, the minister of that church, and made the arrangements. Our class went over to the black church one Sunday, and their class came over to our church one Sunday. It wasn't much, but it was a beginning. The interesting thing, though, is that it wasn't exactly parallel. The black parents who came to our church brought their young children and put them in the nursery. The white people in our church left their kids back at the white church or with relatives somewhere else. Our two children, because we had a new baby just born, were the only ones in the black nursery, so they got lots of special attention. Yes, like many young couples, it was having kids that got us back into church. But what about the whole God thing, the rejection of the angry old man with the long white beard? If I was going to church, I needed to rethink the God thing as much as I was now rethinking the race thing. I just had to start from the bottom and rebuild on a better foundation. I read Tillich and Buber and Cox. I thought of it as doing what St. Paul says we all need to do. When I was a child, I thought as a child, but when I became an adult, I put away childish things. I especially liked a book by Alfred North Whitehead called Religion in the Making. Whitehead discusses the evolution of our concept of God. It's not God that changes, Whitehead says. It's our idea, our understanding of God. So I thought, that's what I'm doing. I'm evolving my idea of God. Of course, in the last decade or two, the new atheism has emerged, replacing the quiet, interrogative mode of the 19th century with the aggressive, even hostile denial of God's existence. Liberal theologians have had to develop a response to those attacks. As the keepers of the flame, they're supposed to answer those who declare there is no God. One of my favorite such theologians is Marcus Borg, or rather was. He died just this past month. God rest his soul. Borg's response to the hostile atheist was this: tell me about the God you don't believe in. Is it that all-knowing, omnipotent figure who jealously enjoins us to have no other gods before me? Is it the God who rewards and punishes either here or hereafter? Is it a God who lives in the sky and calls his children home? Is it the God who called for the sacrifice of Isaac and Jesus Christ and Martin Luther King? That figure was not Borg's idea of God, nor is it mine. Since I returned to church in my 20s, this often put me on the liberal freethinking end of the churches in the South that Barbara and I went to. Here at SUUC, however, I don't have to be the radical questioner of faith anymore. I can relax into a quiet exploration of what it is we talk about when we talk about God. It's not easy to talk about God, for sure, but it's not easy to talk about race either. It's simpler to stick to the orthodoxy. But I find this heterodoxic tradition much richer. I'm still adjusting to it. I've only been here a couple of years since Barbara and I retired here from Chicago. The same is true of race. It's not easy to talk about race. Like God, race is a social construct, which is its own reality, a reality with a substantial impact on society. It's much simpler if we follow the advice of the Puerto Rican women to Maria in West Side Story. stick to your own kind. And I was back with my own kind, as it were, standing in that pulpit of my little white country church. But then again, I wasn't. I'd changed. But I knew what I had to speak about. I knew that I had to become a witness and an advocate for the end of racism, which so dominates our society. And what better place to start than the community in which I was reared? First, I attended the Memorial March in downtown Memphis after the assassination, and then I prepared my homecoming address. From the Bethel pulpit, I could see faces of those who had taught me as a child. A lot of them I was kin to. I was not accusatory in tone, but I raised the issue unambiguously, urging the need for change both in behavior and in heart. Afterwards, only one person spoke to me critically, a woman I didn't even know. Most people did not comment, but a few whispered that they would like to say those things, but I have to live here. And of course, it was easier for me. I think it was their way, and several of them decided to make copies of the sermon and give them to people who wanted them. I think that was their quiet way of supporting what I said. I had talked about race. It wasn't much, but it was a start. As for talking about God, I have decided, after mulling it over these last 2 years, not to give up God. I still like to say, God be with you, when my friends depart for God knows where. I still like to sing, may God bless and keep you always, without any air quotes. I like to say, you're in my prayers, to people who are facing the kind of tragic events that sometimes we hear about in joys and sorrows. What kind of God, you ask? My God is not as defined as that of some folks. It is not a God in any way personal or person-like. No anthropomorphism for me. I see and resist as much as possible the tendency to make God in my own image. Nor am I willing to adopt George Lucas's God in Star Wars, the Force. Sure, Obi-Wan Kenobi is a Christ figure, but it's just mythologies, you know, picking up on. It doesn't help me to say who or what God is. If cornered by an aggressive atheist, and thank goodness I haven't met any of those here, who insists on a definition of my God, I fall back on that verse in 1 John 4:16. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. I see love as a universal force of attraction. It makes me think of another universal force of attraction. Newton gave it a name, a formula too, but we won't talk about that. Newton's law says every physical body in the universe is attracted to every other body in direct proportion to mass and inverse proportion to gravity. Our universe seems to grow more complex with each new episode of cosmos. It's governed by natural laws, one of which is the universal law of gravitation. I started out as a physics major, but I drifted into literature as a career. But I still love the laws of physics. I believe in the God of universal gravity, the God of universal love. And I believe that this love must extend to all people of all races and all beliefs, not limited just to our own kind. In the end, we only cheat ourselves if we reject others based on what is called race or what is called God.